All right, and welcome to the Contributing Factor Podcast, where we take you even deeper into the no-spin zone. I'm your host, Robert Samuel, a producer here at the O'Reilly Factor. A happy new year to everyone. I hope everyone enjoyed the holidays and you're holding strong to your New Year's resolutions. I know I certainly am not. In today's episode, I talked to James Mitchell, a psychologist who helped develop the CIA's enhanced interrogation program for terrorists after 9/11. For years, there has been an intense debate over the effectiveness of the CIA's program, which included techniques such as waterboarding and sleep deprivation to try to get uncooperative terrorists to reveal secrets. In December 2014, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, chaired by Democrat Dianne Feinstein, made public a report that concluded that CIA detainees had been tortured and that enhanced interrogation techniques, also known as EITs, were ineffective. Numerous high-level CIA leaders have harshly criticized the Senate report, and the CIA put out a statement that said EITs, quote, did produce intelligence that helped thwart attack plans, capture terrorists, and save lives, unquote. In this episode, Dr. James Mitchell tells his side of the story and discusses what it was like to interrogate individuals like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the chief architect of the 9/11 attacks. Jim is the author of the new book Enhanced Interrogation, Inside the Minds and Motives of the Islamic Terrorists Trying to Destroy America. Here's my conversation with Jim. So, Jim, you were one of the chief architects of the Enhanced Interrogation Program on terrorists following the 9/11 attacks. Enhanced interrogation includes things like waterboarding and sleep deprivation. Before we get into whether the Enhanced Interrogation Program worked, let's talk about how you had such a large role in the program. You weren't even an employee of the CIA. So describe the steps you took to becoming one of the chief crafters of the CIA's Enhanced Interrogation Program.
Yeah, I think in some ways you're giving me a little more credit than I deserve, but I'll answer that question. You know, one of the things that I had done is I had spent a lot of time in the Air Force initially in a resistance to interrogation training program, where essentially you teach warfighters at high risk of capture how to resist answering questions. And in the context of doing that, I had spent, literally thousands and thousands of hours watching people of a variety of ethnic backgrounds and levels of training try to protect secrets, both in the intro course and then in the, kind of the master's level, the graduate level course that they teach only those people at highest risk of capture, like our counter-terrorist units. And so I had a pretty extensive background in resistance training. The CIA got a hold of a manual called the Manchester Manual, which is a manual that the Al-Qaeda and other Islamists were using to train their folks to resist interrogations. And it was really based on material that was stolen from the Army, U.S. Army Special Forces, by a guy by the name of Ali Muhammad, who in a weird way was a member of U.S. Army Special Forces. But in the summertime, he would go over and fight in the jihad in Afghanistan against the Russians. And he just stole their entire resistance to interrogation process and turned it over to the Islamists. And so what they did, what the CIA did, was they asked me and Dr. Jensen if we would take a look at this manual.
And that's Bruce Jensen, your partner, right?
It's Jensen, J-E-S-S-E. Jensen,
yeah.
So they asked me and Dr. Jessen if we would take a look at that manual, and, you know, not from the perspective of experts on Al-Qaeda, but rather from people who had spent literally thousands of hours looking at resistance training and were familiar with the way the Americans trained people to resist interrogation, to look at these materials that had been stolen from the Americans and give them some idea about how terrorists who were trying to employ them were likely to look when they were being interrogated, what they were likely to do and what they were likely to say and how they were likely to act. And we did that and thought nothing of it, really. We went on about our business. Bruce worked for the Department of Defense, and I had a personal services contract with them working a different issue. And then when Abu Zubaydah got captured, the CIA called me up one day out of the blue and just asked me to return immediately to headquarters. And then they asked me to deploy with these CIA officers who were going to question Zubeda and the FBI team.
And he was one of the top Al-Qaeda terrorists, correct?
He never swore bayat to Osama bin Laden. And this is one of those things that kind of gets a little bit confused. He worked with them. He lived with them. He gave them $10,000 to do 9/11, right? Mm-hmm. He trained people that worked with them. He moved money for them. He forged passports for them. But one of the points that people quibble about now is, well, he never really actually swore bayat to bin Laden, so he wasn't a member of Al-Qaeda. No, but he himself said, I was the same as Al-Qaeda because we share the same goals. Mm-hmm. The other thing to remember about him is that his diary is publicly available. It was through a Freedom of Information Act. It was released to Jason Leopold. And if you Google Jason Leopold, CIA, Abu Zubaydah diaries, you can download volume 6 and look at the last few pages where he talks about how he's declared war on America and he's got all these attacks he wants to do, and including nuclear attacks on a couple of different pages. So he was a pretty bad guy. So we caught, they caught him, and I deployed initially with them to give them some indication of what resistance strategies he was using. And then when I don't know, have you read my book?
I have read your book, yes.
Okay. In my book, I describe in great detail what actually led him to shut down, which was basically some things that the FBI did. And when that happened, the CIA folks drew everybody back to headquarters. This is the summertime, say June, July, and had a big meeting. And at one of those meetings in July, when it became apparent to me that they were going to use physical coercion on Abu Zubaydah, I suggested to them that if they were going to do this, and underline the if they were going to do this, they should consider using some of those SEER-related techniques that have been used since the 1950s without producing any kind of, you know, mental or physical harm that was pervasive.
Yeah, and what were those interrogation techniques? Because there is a lot of confusion about what exactly enhanced interrogation is. Some people just equate it with torture. I mean, what when you say enhanced interrogation, what are you talking about?
I'm talking about the 10 or 11 things that we recommended on that list and the Department of Justice said were legal. Mm-hmm. I'm only talking about those things. I don't have them memorized off the top of my head, but it included things like an attention grab and walling, which is where you bounce a person's shoulders off a specially constructed, very flexible wall while you protect their neck with a special collar to prevent any kind of whiplash or harm to the head. It included waterboarding, and it included a couple of what people would call stress positions, but very specific ones. So there were about 10 or 11 of those things. I can't remember. Like I said, it's been 15 years.
Right.
So I don't have that list memorized. But if it wasn't on that list, Bruce and I didn't do it. But there is a lot of confusion about all of these other things, many of which should have never happened, in my opinion, that get equated with enhanced interrogation techniques, because everybody just calls everything the CIA did enhanced interrogation.
What are those things? Because part of why I wanted you to come on this podcast is sort of to break through all the confusion, because there's a million different inspector general reports. There's a Senate report. There's all these reports in the media, and it's hard to discuss these things because a lot of the information is classified. So what do you think people are getting wrong about or in the general perception is wrong about what enhanced interrogation was?
Well, one thing is that it's illegal. You know, it was opined at least four, maybe five times in the Justice Department that those techniques that Bruce and I used were legal, didn't violate the Constitution, and didn't violate treaties, our treaty obligations. And the other thing is that there's a lot of confusion about how long those things took place, because if you just read some of the folks who are critics in the press, you would think that Abu Zubaydah was held in CIA custody for 1,623 days before he was transferred to Guantanamo by President Bush in 2006. And you would think that every day he was subjected to enhanced interrogations. But in fact, he was only subjected 14 of those days. Oh, wow. So that means 1,609 days he was working with the CIA and not being subjected to enhanced interrogation techniques. Same thing for KSM. KSM was held for 1,285 days.
Yeah. And we should say KSM is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, one of the chief architects of 9/11.
not one of the chief architects.
The chief architect, yeah.
The chief architect. He hadn't sworn bayat to Osama bin Laden either. He didn't become a member of al-Qaeda until after 9/11. But he was subjected to 21 days. That's 3 weeks of enhanced interrogation. There was another 170 weeks where he received no enhanced interrogation, no interrogation at all. He was debriefed like you would an asset. So I think one of the misperceptions is how much they were used. The other misperception, I think, is that that what I did was I sat down with a piece of paper and designed this program, when in fact what I did was give them a list of things to try out, to see if they were legal, and for them to vet on their own, which they did, and for them to decide which if any they were going to use. And at the time that I gave them this list, I had no idea they were going to ask me to do them. It was only later when Jose Rodriguez and another one of his senior colleagues stopped me, I think, as I was leaving
and they were top CIA officials, correct?
Jose Rodriguez at the time was the chief of the counterterrorism center at the CIA. He went on to become the chief of clandestine services. Mm-hmm. So very senior, very, very senior person in the CIA. So they stopped me as I was leaving the room and asked me if I would help them. And I originally said, oh, sure, thinking that they wanted me to do what I had been doing, which is basically commenting on which resistance techniques the person was employing. But he said, no, we want you to do these interrogations. And I said, well, I can't do them by myself. And I was reluctant to do them. And then essentially what I had to do was a lot of soul searching. You know, I had to think about, for me, what the moral implications were. Mm-hmm. You know, there's this notion that we sometimes hear that the terrorists have a right, these people who are not U.S. citizens, who have voluntarily taken up arms to destroy our way of life, who have killed thousands of Americans, have the right to protect the information that would be needed to stop the next attack. And what I had to do was balance, you know, that perceived notion that physical coercion, even if it's legal, shouldn't be used against people who are trying to kill us, versus my moral obligation to save American lives. And I know people can disagree. I know people do disagree, you know. But in my mind, nothing about the temporary discomfort of a terrorist, particularly when you were using techniques that were judged to be legal, superseded my obligation to protect American lives.
Yeah. And you directly interrogated KSM yourself. Do you think the enhanced interrogation of KSM worked in getting information to help stop future terrorist attacks?
Well, yes, it did, actually. The enhanced interrogations of KSM often gets conflated with waterboarding. The interesting thing about waterboarding is that the press and the media seem obsessed with waterboarding, but really only three terrorists were waterboarded. I waterboarded almost as many attorneys as I did terrorists. In fact, I waterboarded one attorney, assistant attorney general, who was tasked with deciding whether or not waterboarding was torture, and he wanted to be waterboarded before he made up his mind. Mm-hmm. I waterboarded him, and a few days later, he opined that it wasn't torture, although it sucked pretty bad.
Yeah. You know?
And we didn't dial it back for him. We actually waterboarded him the full length of the time, much more so than we did on the average person, because the average amount of time that we poured water was about 8 seconds for most of these folks. And the result of that is there are lots of pores, which is what people get crazy about, but there's also lots more opportunity to breathe, because if it's an average of 8 seconds, there's a lot of 3 second, 2 second, 1 second, and then just a few. In fact, I can tell you there were only two times when it was for 20 seconds and one time when it was for 40 seconds. Whereas the actual legal guidance said you could do from 20 to 40 seconds and give them three breaths for 20 minutes. And Bruce and I both felt that would be overwhelming.
Yeah.
But the EIT that worked on KSM was actually walling and sleep deprivation.
Yeah. Could you describe what walling is exactly for our audience? Because I don't think many people know about that.
Well, walling is, you build this special wall that's made out of 1/4-inch plywood with no studs behind it, no struts behind it at all. And it bounces just like the floor of a professional wrestling mat. You know, there's a lot of noise and a lot of bounce. And in fact, the noise is increased by the fact that you hang a clapper behind it, which is another like quarter sheet of plywood that hangs behind it on a couple of straps, so that when somebody is bounced off the wall, that piece of wood hits the wall and makes a lot of noise. And it's generally just a lot of noise. I'm not exaggerating. I've been walled hundreds, maybe thousands of times, because every time we did this kind of training, and I was involved in it, I volunteered to be the walling dummy because I wanted to know that they were doing it properly. And the mm-hmm. only way to know you're doing it properly is to let them wall you, not watch somebody else get walled. Mm-hmm. And so, what would happen is you would put a special collar around the person's neck and pull them forward, leaving their feet on the ground, just bounce their shoulders, their upper shoulders off of that and back off that wall, mm-hmm. controlling. You do that two or three times.
Yeah. And going back to KSM, what information did he withhold before the enhanced interrogation that he revealed after the enhanced interrogation?
He withheld quite a bit of information about who his contacts were, who is giving money to whom, details about Hambali's attack. Here's what got the CIA all cranked up in the first place and willing to use coercive pressure. They knew that there was another catastrophic attack planned by Al-Qaeda. There was a lot of chatter. If you think back to that time, there was just a lot of threat information, a lot of chatter. But they also knew for a fact that Osama bin Laden had met with the Pakistanis that were passing out that nuclear technology to these rogue states that export terrorists. And that Pakistani scientists had said, the hardest part is getting the fissionable material. And Osama bin Laden had said, what if we've already got it? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that sort of sent chills throughout the whole program. You got all this talk about another catastrophic attack, and you got this, near certain fact that Osama bin Laden is looking for nuclear technology so he can build a weapon. And so in the context of that, along with the anthrax attacks and that, you know, who knew who they were coming from at the time, later on they found out they were from a scientist who had stolen some anthrax, but at the time you didn't know whether it was Al-Qaeda or someone else. Right. And they're busy trying to stop these next set of attacks.
Right. So what specific information did KSM give you guys after the enhanced interrogation that led you to stop attacks? Because I think that's where the debates is all about. Like, what actually happened as a result of interrogations that stopped things?
Well, let me make two points first. The first point is there's a book called Rebuttal that was put together by ex-CIA directors and ex-senior people at CIA, and it includes the Senate Select Committee Minority Report, which is a pushback against the majority report, and it includes the CIA's response to that report that everybody's looking at from Feinstein and her cronies. Mm-hmm. And they, in detail, go over lots of plots, I think 17 or 18, that were disrupted, most as a result of EITs. So, but in terms of KSM, we got information from him that allowed us to identify who couriered the money to a man named Hambali, who was the Bali bomber. Hambali had this crew of folks that he was training to be muscle, and he was training to fly planes into buildings on the West Coast. His intent was to hit the tallest buildings in Los Angeles, Seattle, and Chicago. Mm-hmm. So we got information that allowed us to eventually catch Hambali, and then eventually catch Hambali's lieutenants, and eventually disrupt that entire plot. And also there were people inside the United States that were already on the FBI's radar, but the FBI didn't really know what they were up to. Well, they were working for KSM, and information from KSM highlighted what they were trying to do. For example, here's an example. One of KSM's plots was to set off blow up gas stations up and down the East Coast of the United States. He had a man inside of the United States who actually had a gas delivery route, who actually was driving one of those big gas trucks and pumping gas into gas stations. And they were busy working on trying to come up with a bursting charge that would not just blow up the gas station, because they weren't really all that interested in just setting fire to the tank underneath the pumps. They wanted to blow all that gasoline up into the air and set it on fire, sort of like a fuel air bomb would go off. So they wanted a lot of aeration in it. And so they were working on developing that fusing and detonation device. And they had a man in New York City who had a import-export company who were importing and exporting things for KSM into the country. And he was going to import the explosives and the fusing for this thing. Those folks were rounded up. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, his lying about Ahmed al-Kuwaiti signaled to the folks who were questioning him that al-Kuwaiti may be an important courier for getting to bin Laden. Mm-hmm. See, this gets all confused in the way that Feinstein keeps track of what works and what doesn't work. But
I guess we should tell our listeners who aren't that up to speed on this topic that Dianne Feinstein in her Senate Intelligence Committee put out this big report that basically said enhanced interrogation didn't work and accused you and others of actually torturing to no good effect.
Right. And what she did do in this 5-year, $40 million thing was not talk to a single CIA director, not talk to a single CIA senior person, not talk to a single CIA analyst, not talk to a single CIA targeter, no guards, none of us, no one who actually knew what had happened, because they didn't want a dissenting opinion. They had their mind made up when they published this thing.
Yeah. Why do you think, I mean, you just laid out quite a bit of evidence that enhanced interrogation worked, or at least had plots were disrupted as a result of it. What do you think motivated Dianne Feinstein and her allies to put out this report that comes to the complete opposite conclusion?
Well, I think it was a prosecutorial brief. They basically, Feinstein made it clear right away that it bothered her conscience that we had used these techniques, even though they were deemed legal by the Justice Department.
Mm-hmm. So you think it was kind of a moral motivation?
I believe it was a moral motivation, you know, similar to what Senator McCain had said. You know, Senator McCain had said these kinds of techniques are illegal and should remain illegal. And then someone asked the senator, well, what if there's a ticking time bomb situation? He said, well, then I expect the CIA interrogators will do what's necessary. And at their trial, if they actually saved any lives, we'll take that into consideration. Well, my reaction to that kind of talk, as a guy who was actually thrown under the bus for this specific reason, is that the people who say those kinds of things want to live under the protection of the men and women who are willing to risk their lives to protect them, but don't want to have their backs when it comes down to it by either deciding it's legal or not legal. Mm-hmm. If it's not legal, don't expect us to do it. Right. If it's legal, don't throw us under the bus when we do what you ask us to do. Mm-hmm. And so what you end up with is you end up in this situation where you get some people who say, well, you know, EITs don't work. All you really need to do is build rapport. It's almost like what General Mattis said, right? General Mattis said, well, give me a couple of beers and a pack of cigarettes and I can get more out of them. Mm-hmm. Well, you have to ask yourself, what would General Mattis do? Would General Mattis give up information that would get Americans killed for a Michelob and a pack of Winstons? No, neither would any other senior person, and neither did KSM. Mm-hmm. When KSM was first captured, he was held in Pakistan for several days where they tried to debrief him or question him using what they called tea and respectful conversation. Tried that for several days where he rocked and he prayed and he did all of these other things and he threatened and he glared and he did everything. And then years later, long after the EITs were over, he and I were talking about that particular period in his capture. And he said, those guys were clowns. They thought I was going to turn on my God for a cup of tea and a handful of dates, mm-hmm. you know, and that's the problem. The folks who are trying to destroy us are crucifying children and burning people in cages, you know, giving them a couple of cookies and saying you like them and there's no reason for them to fight us. Let me tell you what KSM told me about that kind of talk. Mm-hmm. KSM said that our desire to have the rest of the world like us was actually a weakness that their God had put in place so that they could defeat us, that our civil liberties, that our reliance on the rule of law, that our Bill of Rights, those were all weaknesses, tools that the Islamists could use to defeat us.
Mm-hmm. And just to go a little bit further on that, you directly, as you said, talked with KSM. What was it like interrogating and doing enhanced interrogation techniques on KSM? What is it like to be in the room with the man that killed 3,000 people on 9/11?
Well, it depended on where in that 1,285 days he was. In the first part, when I did the initial neutral assessment, the way these interrogations work is we give them lots of opportunities not to have to experience EITs. And because I look more like somebody's uncle than an interrogator, you know, I went in and I asked him, you know, for the information. And he said, soon you will know. And he was belligerent and haughty and arrogant. But after EITs, it was more like talking to Yoda. You know, mm-hmm. he's a Sufi. He has a sort of a mischievous approach to his Islamist beliefs. You know, he likes to study the mysticism that's involved in their holy writings. And so he was like talking to a spiritual leader.
Mm-hmm. Was it ever scary talking with him?
No, it wasn't scary in the sense of I wasn't afraid of him. You know, he was a short, hairy, fat guy, you know. A guy that was a little scary to talk to is Hambali. Mm-hmm. You know, Hambali was muscular and stout and an excellent karate expert. So he and after his EITs were over, they actually let him practice karate in his cell. You know, the other ones that like to do karate could practice karate in their cells because they were working with us and we wanted to keep them working with us, you know. So he was actually kind of a scary guy because he was hard to read. He had sort of a militaristic persona, and he pretended he didn't speak English, but he spoke English much better than we had thought he did.
Mm-hmm. And you are a psychologist, and having spent all this time with terrorists and interrogating them, what do you think most Americans don't understand about the mindset of terrorists?
Well, I think they don't understand how committed they are to their God. They believe that the only way for them, they think it's, you know, they feel about religion. Americans, I think, in a lot of ways feel that they're more like secular or cultural Muslims, and that's not the case. These Islamists, they absolutely believe that God has given them a mandate, a requirement to impose Sharia law on the whole world or suffer the torments of the grave. And that's what they intend to do. I mean, they're not going to quit doing it. And they're going to do it by any means possible. I mean, Al-Qaeda would like to bring us down with some sort of a nuclear chemical attack. But, you know, KSM told me that the practical way to impose Sharia law on the world, because they're looking, we look short term, they're looking long term. Mm-hmm. He said the practical way to do that was by immigration and by outbreeding non-Muslims. He said that like-minded jihadis would immigrate to the United States, wrap themselves in our civil liberties for protection, support themselves in our welfare system while they spread their jihadi message and ratcheted up the acceptance of Sharia law. And then when the time was right, rise up and violently impose Sharia from within.
It's pretty interesting. I read that and that really stood out because you of course see it's happening more so in Europe with the mass immigration there, but it certainly could happen here. And you don't know what's motivating all of this. But one thing I know we got to go, but one last question I had for you is Donald Trump, our new president-elect, has hinted that he might bring enhanced interrogation back. Barack Obama, of course, got rid of it one of his first days in office. Do you think it's a good idea to bring it back?
Let me make a point first.
Go ahead.
Right? The point I would make is if it was illegal, like Feinstein had said, they wouldn't have had to pass a law in 2015 making it illegal. Mm-hmm. As it stands right now, the mall cop down the road from me has more options for interrogating terrorists than the CIA or the other people in the intelligence community. Literally, law enforcement techniques are off the table for the CIA and other intelligence communities, whereas they're not off the table for local police. So that's an important point. But what I would say to the president-elect, the question I would ask him is, what are you going to do? Mm-hmm. What are you going to do when you get credible intelligence that there's another impending catastrophic attack and that the person you have in your custody has the information to stop it, they're good at withholding it, they don't want to give it up, and the Army field manual isn't going to work? Mm-hmm. What are you going to do? And I, because we tried all of those things on them before they went to EITs, know that the Army field manual isn't going to work. And for a man like, because we're talking about the worst of the worst. We're not talking about the average guy you roll up on the battlefield, right, which is what the Army field manual stuff was intended to work on. We're talking about the worst of the worst who have themselves created these programs, they're just not going to give that information up for a cookie, some tea, or because they want the interrogator to like them. They just aren't going to do it.
Yeah. Well, Jim, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me. Your book is Enhanced Interrogation: Inside the Minds and Motives of the Islamic Terrorists Trying to Destroy America, and it is a great read. And in stores now. Thanks so much, Jim.
Thanks. Bye.
And that's it for today's episode. Before we go, a quick reminder of the benefits of a premium membership on BillO'Reilly.com. If you join now, you can get any one of Bill's books for free, including his new bestseller, Killing the Rising Sun, or his new children's book he co-authored with James Patterson called Give Please a Chance. Once again, this is Robert Samuel for the Contributing Factor Podcast. Please check out our future posts on BillO'Reilly.com, iTunes, and the Google Play Store.